From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we take a look at Islamic terrorist cells in Europe with New York Times journalist Chris Hedges. He spent the last month traveling in Spain, France, and Belgium, reporting on what he calls the vanguard of new terrorism. Hedges is the Times' former Middle East bureau chief and Balkans bureau chief. Also, we meet Maestro Christoph Eschenbach. Last Sunday, he conducted the Orchestra of St. Luke's during the memorial service at Ground Zero. He's led orchestras in Paris, Hamburg, and Houston. He's recently been named the new music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The anthrax threat continues to spread through Washington, D.C., New Jersey, and New York. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
A New Jersey woman is the first person to contract skin anthrax, even though she does not work directly with the mail. The woman lives near the Hamilton, New Jersey mail facility that may have handled contaminated mail. Officials cannot explain how she got the disease or whether she was infected by simply opening mail. And a New York woman appears to have the more serious inhalation anthrax. She works in a New York hospital and also did not work directly with the mail. In the nation's capital, the post office has closed down two more mail facilities after anthrax spores were found there. Health and postal officials are at a loss to explain these new cases. No new letters have been found for 2 weeks or more, leading some investigators to speculate that there must be more letters out there that have contaminated the mail stream. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the United States has put a small number of troops into northern Afghanistan to direct heavy bombing of Taliban forces. At a news conference today, Rumsfeld said he would not rule out an expanded ground campaign. This was the first acknowledgment by the Pentagon that American soldiers are now based in Afghanistan. The announcement came as nearly 100 U.S. warplanes reportedly bombed Taliban forces and al-Qaeda guerrilla hideouts for a 24th straight day. The commander of U.S. military operations in Afghanistan is denying that the military has run into a stalemate. NPR's Lauren Sheets reports from Tashkent.
General Tommy Franks dismissed reports of frustration in the Pentagon over the pace of the campaign.
Of course, I don't believe that this operation is at a stalemate. I believe that we're on the timeline that we established.
Franks said those expecting a quick victory in Afghanistan failed to understand this war is fundamentally different from others, like the Persian Gulf War. Franks spoke with reporters after meeting Uzbekistan's President Islam Karimov. U.S. Special Forces are deployed at an Uzbek airbase less than 100 miles from the Afghan border. But the mission of the U.S. troops here remains cloaked in secrecy. The Uzbek government only confirms that U.S. soldiers are engaged in humanitarian and search and rescue missions. Lawrence Sheets, NPR News, Tashkent.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is appealing for a quick end to the U.S.-led attacks on Afghanistan. Annan says the halt is needed, not just a pause, so humanitarian relief efforts can continue and winter preparations can get underway. The U.S. has said it will not stop the bombing until it wipes out terrorist camps associated with Osama bin Laden. Annan says quite a bit of food is getting to Afghanistan despite the military operations. Meanwhile, Annan's envoy to Afghanistan is in Pakistan for talks on promoting the establishment of a broad-based government in Afghanistan. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 147 points, the Nasdaq was down 32, and the S&P 500 closed down 18 points. You're listening to NPR News. Jurors in Cincinnati have deadlocked on an involuntary manslaughter charge against a white police officer accused in the death of a black man. But the panel found him innocent today of a misdemeanor assault charge. Robert Jorg had faced up to 5 years in prison if convicted on both charges. He's accused in the asphyxiation death of Roger Owensby. Police say officers stopped Owensby last year to question him about a drug offense and that he was wrestled to the ground and handcuffed after he tried to flee. A coroner concluded Owensby's death was a homicide. Former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic has told the Hague War Crimes Court to stop wasting its time with what he calls a useless procedure. Milosevic says he'd prefer the court read him his sentence now. NPR's Rick Spicer reports from The Hague.
An angry Slobodan Milosevic said the indictments against him were at the intellectual level of a retarded 7-year-old child. He said, as he has before, that the purpose of the court is to justify NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia by putting all the blame on him for violence in Kosovo. he asked that video cameras be removed from his cell, saying he wasn't a suicide risk and that he had to stay alive to fight on and topple the court. The outburst followed a presentation by the court's prosecutor of how she is preparing her case. She will call on nearly 200 witnesses in each of three separate indictments for Kosovo, Croatia, and Bosnia. The indictments will be brought together in the same trial. The overall procedure may last up to 3 years. The trial will start next February. Nick Spicer, NPR News, The Hague.
Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres says he'll probably meet Yasser Arafat at a weekend conference in Spain. It would be the first high-level contact since Israel launched incursions 2 weeks ago. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. In the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks, a European dragnet in eight countries has fanned out through London, Madrid, Milan, and other cities to hunt down militant Islamic terrorist cells with links to Osama bin Laden. Authorities have arrested more than 30 suspects in France alone, with more arrests coming daily. My guest, Chris Hedges, has covered the European investigation for The New York Times, reporting from Spain, France, and Belgium. From 1991 to 95, Hedges was the Times' Middle East bureau chief, based in Cairo. During the Gulf War, he was one of several reporters captured and detained by Iraqi soldiers. Hedges reports that the European terrorist network is composed of two major groups. One is the Takfiri, a radical ultra-conservative group that traces its origins back to Egypt in the 1960s. The second group are the Salafists, who trace their roots to the Algerian insurgency against the French. I spoke with Chris Hedges this morning about how these terrorist organizations operate. I asked him about one of the plots recently uncovered in the investigation in Europe to blow up the American embassy in Paris.
The plan was to pack explosives into a minivan and use a Tunisian driver, to plow the van into the embassy and blow it up. And the tip-off to the plot came from Jamal Begal, this French-Algerian national who was picked up in Dubai. And police swooped down in Belgium, primarily where they were planning the attack, and confiscated huge amounts of chemicals, some weapons and plans to carry out the assault, which was to take place at the end of this year or the beginning of next year.
And what has the plot revealed to officials about how these terrorist attacks are orchestrated? For instance, did the directives come straight from Osama bin Laden, or did the group, a specific group, plan and aim to carry out the attack independently?
In this case, it appears that the directive did come from Osama bin Laden. Begal talks about a final meeting where he was given the date or the approximate date the attack was to be carried out. He was given about $60,000 to fund the attack. He was on his way back. He was actually traveling. He was coming from a camp in Afghanistan and was on his way to Morocco, where he would go to the Algerian or the French embassy and say that he lost his passport. This is a very common technique, essentially allowing him to travel into Europe without record of his journey into Afghanistan and Pakistan. And then he was supposed to go on to Spain and up into France and give the green light. He, of course, never made it. So in the large attacks, it does appear that there is a direct link, or at least a seeking of approval on the part of the bin Laden organization. The planning for the attack in Europe was very slipshod. For instance, the plotters in Brussels bought all of their chemicals at the same store. They just did not have the precision or the care that a Mohammed Atta, the ringleader of the hijackers here had. So, One sees, I think, that the caliber or quality of those carrying out these attacks varies and, of course, makes a tremendous difference in what is possible and what isn't.
Now, the Bush administration has focused on Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda as the ringleader of the September 11th operation. And listening to the evidence and the information that's come out of the investigations in Europe, it seems as if that conception of a top-down organization of terrorist networks has been called into question. Do you find that happening among officials?
Yes, and the French are particularly adamant about this, and they see it as a point of contention with the American intelligence services. And the French have been doing this well and been doing it longer at this point than just about anyone else. That's exactly right, that, you know, they said that these notions of networks and cells are our attempt to impose a structure on a group of people who essentially don't have much of a structure. Many of the organizations are freelance. They look at Osama bin Laden as a kind of, ideological godfather, the Italian police had bugged this apartment outside of Milan of these group of North Africans who considered themselves followers of Osama bin Laden and members of sort of this radical vanguard. However, there isn't any evidence that they actually had any contact with Osama bin Laden. They talked a lot about carrying out various attacks in Europe. I think they even mentioned, using poison and other things. But they appear to have been self-motivated, self-directed. It reminded me very much of when I covered the conflict in Algeria after the military took over in the middle 90s. The fighting there was quite intense. It subsided, but it was pretty nasty. I mean, I think the regime was about to go. And I would meet with members of the Islamics. It was all clandestine meetings. We would go into a neighborhood like Belcourt, and I would be picked up by an appropriate cab driver and always left in a house under construction. Then about a half hour later, the leaders would come and give an interview, and then they would leave, and I'd have to wait another hour before I could leave for security reasons. But there was a fear even among the leaders. I mean, these were high-ranking leaders in the Islamic resistance for my own safety, because they said, you're safe with us, but three or four blocks away, Ahmed Mohammed may have gotten their hands on a pistol and see a foreigner and decide to, carry out a liquidation in the name of the revolution. And I think that kind of chaotic nature is also part of this sort of loose terrorist network in Europe, that oftentimes people who define themselves, and we saw this again with the Palestinian uprising, especially the first one, people who define themselves as being members of the organization, the titular heads of the organizations may not know of their existence.
Now, given the chaotic and the tangled web of associations among these organizations, what's your sense of what dent the arrests to date have made in European operations?
Well, I think the arrests have been significant, at least in the short term, because they did manage to get people who were clearly planning to attack American interests in Paris. There's no question. I mean, they found in the basement of a small restaurant in Brussels, the Nile, all of the chemicals and material to create a pretty powerful explosive device. So in the short term, I think they've done pretty well. In terms of penetrating the organization, when one speaks to officials in Europe, they're very nervous because there are many self-defined cells we talk of them as sleeper cells. I think that's a bit of a misnomer, because sleeper cells, that refers to the old sort of Soviet system of sending people over and them having worked 10 years and then having them carry out an activity. I don't know that these cells have left a centralized location with the notion that they'll be tapped one day. I think it's more that they have that sort of personal affiliation and are open, should the need ever arise or the proper context arrives, to carry out activities on behalf of Osama bin Laden's network or people who claim to represent Osama bin Laden's network. And then because these people have no, unlike past radical groups, they live a lifestyle that often makes it appear that they are integrated into European society. Many of these people are second generation Algerians or Tunisians or whatever, and they often don't even speak very good Arabic. They've been through the French system. They often carry a French passport because of their concept of what is permissible under this type of jihad. They are unshaven. They wear Western clothes. There's evidence that they drink, and this makes them, at least outwardly, they appear to have assimilated into European culture when, in fact, they're waiting to strike back.
I'm speaking with New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. He spent the last month in Spain, France, and Belgium reporting on the radical Islamic terrorist network in Europe. He was the Middle East bureau chief for the Times from 1991 to 1995, based in Cairo. We'll talk more, Chris, after the break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Chris Hedges. He's an investigative journalist for the New York Times. He spent the last month in Spain, France, and Belgium reporting on the radical Islamic terrorist network in Europe. Chris, is there a pattern emerging from the arrests made so far about how young Muslims in Europe become radicalized? And many reports I've read say that the path leads through London, that London is referred to as a finishing school for terrorists.
I think that's correct. There are interesting patterns. Many of the people, now this, of course, was not true in the case of the hijackers, but in the case of the European groups, a large number of the, a huge percentage of the people who are involved in these groups often were either born in Europe, in France, or came to France when they were very young, 4, 5, 6 years old. They tended to grow up in these huge government-subsidized housing projects that ring French cities. I went out and did a story about one in Paris where several radicals had grown up and come from. And it's very tough in Europe for immigrants to integrate. It's tough in any society for immigrants to integrate. But I think our society is a little more, perhaps at least, certainly in the urban centers, a little more accommodating. In France, there has long been the sting of racism. France, of course, has its long history with the Algerian War of Independence, where 1 million Algerians died. And there's no question that, you know, a huge percentage of the prison population in France is immigrant. I went up to towns around Lille, and unemployment for immigrants or the sons and daughters of immigrants is running at 10 or 20, 30%, that's 2 or 3 times higher than the unemployment rate in France. So there is this terrible tension that many second-generation immigrants feel, and that is that they don't really finally feel that they belong in France, as Frenchified as they are. And they don't belong in the home country or their country of origin because they've essentially grown up European. And this has created a very volatile and dangerous kind of identity crisis. You find also, interestingly, in these European networks, French citizens, young men who tended to also grow up in these housing projects. The nickname for them are the White Moors. And we saw in several of these cells French converts who had gone to Bosnia or Chechnya and who were an integral part, in some cases led some of these cells. The difference between these new terrorist groups and the old terrorist groups is that the old groups would tend to congregate around mosques. Here, people get involved in sort of the study of Islam, but one of the marked features of both the Salafis and the Takfiris is that they tend not to pray or carry out their worship in public places. They do it in their apartments in tiny groups. They withdraw from the mosques themselves, which makes it much harder for police and intelligence to track them.
Is that why they do it?
I think they do it for two reasons. One, they are security conscious, but also their radicalism is one that shuts them off from... I went up to a town, Roubaix, outside of Lille, where many of these people came from, and talked to the people in the mosque. And they said that there was a group of about 10 or 20 young men who went on sort of a crime spree in France and carried out several attacks and killed a policeman, et cetera. And they said that this group of young men just became more and more radical until finally the mosque itself was too staid and too conservative for them, and they pulled out. So I think that that one has to remember that this is a really tiny, extremely militant strain, even within conservative Islam, and that they often and that they're very unforgiving. Their breaks, I mean, it's a real black or white situation for them. I mean, one is either with them or against them. There are very few nuances. So the recruitment is often done in the mosques by the Takfiris and the Salafis. But then as they become involved in these organizations, at least from what we've seen, they tend to pull out of the mosques. You mentioned London. London is key. You're right. London is sort of the clearinghouse for these groups, and that the ideological leaders of these groups are based there. There's three or four. They decide who goes on to Afghanistan, who gets selected, and one saw with those people that rose was sort of within the ranks of these groups or became important figures in Europe that at one point or another they all ended up in London. And they moved eventually from London to camps in Afghanistan. But yes, London was certainly with the French, the clearinghouse. And the French have complained frequently to the British about the presence of these clerics. The French judicial system is just much tougher. I mean, they just don't allow these. They don't give these people visas, and they throw them out. It's very hard for organizers or leaders to survive very long in France.
Now, you write that there's evidence that many of these terrorist cells in Europe have formed alliances based on shared military experience in Bosnia. Can you talk about that? Did Islamic holy warriors come from all over Europe to fight in the Balkans?
Yes, they did. And I covered the end of the war in Bosnia in 1995, and the Mujahideen, while not terribly numerous, probably 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 people, were a fearsome, well-trained fighting force, many of whom had combat experience either from Afghanistan or from Chechnya. And this has been probably the most important bond that brings these radicals together and the glue that holds these particular cells or groups together, that the shared combat experience in these places, and I think that's true, with soldiering anywhere, is the element that that fuels the movement, and people don't trust anybody outside of that circle. So you repeatedly see in Europe that when the leaders of these cells or groups or networks, whatever you want to call them, are picked up, most of them have had combat experience in Bosnia or Chechnya or Afghanistan. And most of the people, the other ringleaders that they work with, were people who they fought alongside. It's an extremely important element into how these groups are structured.
You say they were a tightly controlled fighting force. Did they have their own code of honor, their own military instructions or codes?
Well, they weren't a force that we were allowed to get near. And reporters who tried... often I got chased away from a Mujahideen based in the town of Zenica with a guy wielding an axe. Other people have had their windows or their cars broken, and they just were a very hostile force, very distrustful of outsiders, especially Western reporters. So those of us who tried to get anywhere near them, we really didn't last too long. Now, there were fairly well substantiated reports that they did practice a real kind of brutality towards the Serbs. And I was with Serb forces, and they had captured, or no, they had fought a Mujahideen unit and killed several Mujahideen and taken photos off the bodies, and which I saw. And the photos showed Mujahideen fighters kicking a severed head of a Serb around on a soccer field and holding it up and jeering, and you know that old sort of story of the body being a trophy in war. Let me just add that the Serbs were not much better. I mean, this was this kind of brutality was a feature of the war in Bosnia on both sides, but the Mujahideen were certainly not excluded from it.
And what happened after the war ended? Did they stay in Bosnia for a time before dispersing throughout Europe?
They did stay in Bosnia. This was a great source of concern for the Clinton administration that put a lot of effort into watching them. The CIA kept very close tabs on them because, of course, they feared an attack on American forces stationed in Bosnia. And we there was just reports a few days ago of a group being broken up in Bosnia that intelligence officials say was planning to do just that, carry out an attack against American forces in Bosnia. So they were there was a lot of pressure put on the Izetbegovic government in Sarajevo to get the Mujahideen out of the country, and they did manage to diminish their numbers. However, many of them were given Bosnian passports, and partly that was because a lot of them married Bosnian women, but also a lot of people who fought in the war were given Bosnian passports. And this has allowed them to come and go around Europe essentially as Bosnians, and particularly into Canada. And Canada has also proven to be one of the sort of major stopping points for many of these Islamic radicals. And that Bosnian connection is key. The Canadians are very open towards permitting Bosnian refugees in, and one has again seen that some of these radicals, who may in fact be Algerian or Egyptian or, you know, a Middle Eastern nationality, traveling on Bosnian passports are able to get in and out of Canada. You know, the Los Angeles airport was done, and he drove over the border from Canada.
Chris Hedges is an investigative journalist with the New York Times. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Maestro Christoph Eschenbach. That's him on piano. He conducted the symphony at the memorial service at Ground Zero on Sunday. This year, he was named the next music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Also, we continue our conversation with Chris Hedges of the New York Times.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our interview with New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. He spent the past month in Spain, France, and Belgium tracking Islamic terrorist networks in Europe. Hedges was the Times Middle East bureau chief based in Cairo from 1991 to 95. During the Gulf War, he was one of the reporters captured and detained by Iraqi soldiers. This summer, he traveled to Khan Yunis, one of eight Palestinian refugee camps in Gaza. He wrote the cover story for the October issue of Harper's Magazine about his experiences there. I asked him why he went to the occupied territories.
I wanted to write a story that tried to explain why young Palestinian young men are so willing to go into shopping malls in Israel and blow themselves up. And I also wanted to explain what it was like to be a Palestinian in one of these refugee camps in Gaza. I think that many Americans aren't aware of how horrendous life is for Palestinians and the kind of pressure that they're put under. So I didn't want to do it rhetorically. I spent 7 days in the refugee camp and just wrote about what it was like on a day-to-day basis. I picked Khan Yunis because it's surrounded on three sides in a kind of horseshoe-shaped position by Israeli military, by settlements, by Jewish settlements, and the Israeli tanks will go up on the dunes and fire into the camp. They're shooting almost every day between Palestinian gunmen and Israeli soldiers. On any given day, there are, four or five wounded. Kids are killed all the time. There's use of live ammunition. It's a particularly brutal and horrible place. And because the Israelis can cut Gaza in half, Khan Yunis is often cut off, completely isolated from Gaza City and from the rest of the Strip.
Could you contrast for us life in the Jewish settlements and life in Khan Yunis?
It's remarkably like the Raj in India. You have within these settlements, of course, they control the aquifers. There's an unlimited supply of water. They have, I went up and looked through the fence. I mean, you can see it from the camp, and it's sort of emerald green lawns, whitewashed villas with terracotta roofs. They have little resort hotels on the beach and horseback riding trails and swimming pools. The camp itself and Khan Yunis, I mean, I did this on purpose, is one of the worst, but within a stone's throw of the settlements, is one of the most crowded places on the planet. It has never been allowed to expand in size. That's not completely the Israelis' fault. When the Egyptians held Gaza, they didn't allow the camps to expand either. But it now houses twice the number of registered refugees, almost 60,000, than it did five decades ago. And you have to remember that the Palestinian growth rate, or the population growth rate for the Palestinians, is one of the highest in the world, 3.7% compared with 1.7% in Israel. You know, the situation for Gazans, there are 1.1 million Palestinians who live in Gaza, is such that the disparity between control over the land means that 20% of the territory belongs to the 16 Jewish settlements, which have about 6,000 Jewish settlers. So, in other words, one-fifth of Gaza is in the hands of 0.5% of the people who live there. These people can't travel. Now, because of the closure, they can't work. The average Palestinian, I think, is living on, two-thirds of Palestinians are now living below the poverty line. And there's no hope of marriage, no hope of employment, no hope of housing. And I found that the only way for these young men finally to affirm themselves is to essentially become a martyr. And the whole cult, there's a kind of horrible necrophilia that's taken over the society, where this is the way you assert who you are, which is through death.
You describe daily encounters between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians there, and most of those killed are young Palestinian boys. What did you see of this fighting while you were there? How did the shooting go down?
Well, every afternoon, you could almost time it, around 3 or 4, the Palestinian kids who have nowhere to play would go out on the dunes, they'd have kites or rag balls and this kind of stuff. And I remember I heard it the first day, and I speak Arabic, so I'm listening over the loudspeaker to the worst curse words in Arabic. And Phrases like, you know, all the Palestinians who live in Khan Yunis are dogs, which is calling an Arab a dog is a particularly insulting. And I just couldn't believe what I heard. And I walked out towards the dunes, and they were over the loudspeaker from an Israeli army jeep on the other side of the electric fence, they were taunting these kids. And these kids started to throw rocks. Most of these kids were 10, 11, 12 years old. And first of all, the rocks were the size of a fist. They were being hurled towards a jeep that was armor-plated. I doubt they could even hit the jeep. And then I watched the soldiers open fire. And it was, I mean, I've seen kids shot in Sarajevo. I mean, snipers would shoot kids in Sarajevo. I've seen death squads kill families in Algeria or El Salvador. But I'd never seen soldiers bait or taunt kids like this and then shoot them for sport. It was, I find it almost inconceivable. And I went back every day, and every day it was the same. And it became, of course, a subtext of my story where I just, kept interviewing parents and imams as to why they let the kids go, the answer being that, in essence, they couldn't control them. There was no room in the houses. There are just too many kids. I found that imams were preaching in the mosques, asking the kids not to go. But the problem is that, you know, the funerals became political events. You know, they would carry the bodies of the newest shaheed through the camp. Hundreds of people would go along behind. They would fire their guns in the air. On the news, that's all they talk about are the new martyrs. On the radio, it's the same. So the kids are almost indoctrinated into this sort of culture of martyrdom, culture of death. And it is something that many parents who, despite, you know, the rhetoric that we often read about, I'm so proud my son died, I mean, that is something totally handed out for consumption by Western reporters or outside reporters, because, you know, sitting around the houses with these people with the puffy eyes and the 1,000-yard stare, it's clear that these parents are as devastated as any parents would be to lose their child. The militants take over these funerals. They put up their banners. They put up their signs. The bodies become props, a kind of political prop to make a political statement. The parents lose control of their children even in death.
You talk to many Palestinians about their conception or their hope or their vision of peace. What did they say?
I think that my piece, I was very bleak. I don't see that. I think Oslo, the Oslo Agreement, the Oslo Accord signed in '93, there was a lot of hope after that. I think there was the possibility that the radical Islamic groups such as Hamas could have been vanquished, or at least made marginal forces, if there was real economic improvement, real investment, if Arafat and the Palestinian Authority had granted real press freedom and some kind of democratic representation, which they have not. He rules the place just like the thugs who rule the rest of the Middle East. And there's such a terrible sense of betrayal and such a sense of disappointment. And life has become so much worse for Palestinians since the peace agreement was signed, since the Oslo agreement was signed, that there is now such a sort of rage and despair that I don't see that chasm being bridged. I walked away in deep despair.
What insights does your experience in Gaza and the West Bank give you into the rise of militant Islam in Europe, or what parallels have you drawn between these two experiences?
That all of this is primarily about self-destruction. That's what it's about. And when you have nothing left to live for and no hope, when you, you can't even assert your own identity, when you can't be anything other than a sort of, a walking bomb or a force for violence, that what this is ultimately about is, I'm going to go down and I'm going to take everyone with me. And I think that that is a common thread both among the radical Palestinians who carry out these kind of suicide attacks, and these deeply alienated, deeply dislocated, deeply frustrated young men who drove planes into the World Trade Center.
Chris Hedges, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. He served as the Times Middle East bureau chief for 4 years in the early 90s. His article about his trip to Gaza is the cover story for the October issue of Harper's Magazine. Coming up, Maestro Christoph Eschenbach. This is Fresh Air. This past Sunday, a memorial was held at Ground Zero in Manhattan for the families of the victims of the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center. My guest, Christoph Eschenbach, conducted the Orchestra of St. Luke's at the service. Eschenbach has personal associations with war and devastation. A native of Germany, he was five and an orphan when World War II ended. Originally a concert pianist, in the last decade he's become one of the top conductors in the world. He's recently been named the new music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra, a position he'll assume in 2003. He also holds posts with orchestras in Paris, Hamburg, Chicago, and Houston. Let's listen to Christoph Eschenbach's latest recording. This is from the first movement of Mozart's Concerto in D Major for violin and piano with the NDR Symphony Orchestra, Midori on violin, Christoph Eschenbach on piano, also conducting. Christoph Eschenbach, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for receiving me.
It's unusual for a conductor to both perform as a soloist and conduct at the same time. It seems to me as if you would need four sides of your brain working at once, that you'd need an entirely different focus to play an instrument than you do to conduct an orchestra.
Well, it's not easy, but it was in Mozart times the habit. And Mozart did himself play and conduct his own piano concerto many times. And so did Beethoven until he couldn't do it anymore because he got totally deaf. And composers performed their own pieces, also conducted, like Schumann conducted his own symphonies, Beethoven did so, Mendelssohn, Liszt, until in the middle of the 19th century, the role of a conductor who conducts other people's works and is not a composer came into the picture, like Bülow. But the habit to perform from the piano a piano concerto is actually an old habit which got lost.
How do you physically do it? You're just at the piano when you play. Do you conduct with your head or...?
I conduct a bit with my head, very much with my eyes. I sometimes with one hand, which is just free for two or three beats in a measure. And, you know, it works.
Can you talk about the physical act of conducting, how you cultivate that, whether you're conscious of what you look like to an audience or just completely oblivious to it? Do whatever it works.
I do whatever works for the orchestra, not whatever works for the audience, because it's much more efficient. If I do what works for the orchestra and get the sound which I want or the temper which I want and which makes a conception acceptable for an audience and convincing for an audience, then the audience will not argue about my body language, I guess. On the other hand, the body language is something also, on the other hand, really also very important, which has to be very perfect in the signification of or in giving signs, giving the right signs with the right movement, the right moment. And you have, so to say, to swallow it, the conscious of what you do with gestures. You have to forget it. You have to totally make it so much your own that it is like you eat a meal, or like you speak with your mouth, and you don't know what movements your lips do. And it's the same thing with the conducting.
Can you give me an example of something you wanted to evoke from an orchestra and a sign that you had figured out that just didn't work that well, that you had to amend or change in some way to make it work?
Well, of course, in my earlier years, I mean, then I have done things which are not so efficient, and I worked on them that they get efficient. And, for example, you have to be very much independent with your two arms and two hands. If you always do simultaneously with both hands the same thing, it's not very efficient. You have to find more possibilities to express. So the left hand mostly is the hand for expression and for sentiment and for emotion. You draw with your left hand often emotions out of the orchestra, whereas your right hand is more for precision.
Do you sometimes try to evoke a certain lyricism from a musician and speak to them in terms of emotion or a more romantic coloring to a piece, and they don't get it? And then you have to say, well, perhaps you need to attenuate this phrase longer, change your language to...
It's the other way around.
Oh, really?
It's the other way around. It's more that you can evoke a very, very lyrical approach to a phrase by speaking about length of notes, about a certain way to play it on a string instrument with a certain amount of bow, or in a certain place between the bridge and the fingerboard, or with a wind player in attacking a note different than the other, then to talk about the blue sky and the sun rising in a over a cornfield, you know.
I'm talking with Christoph Eschenbach. He has just been named the new music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. He's the conductor laureate of the Houston Symphony. He's chief conductor of the Orchestra of Paris and also holds posts in Chicago and Hamburg. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with conductor and pianist Christoph Eschenbach. He's just been named the new conductor of the Philadelphia Orchestra. You were born in Breslau in 1940, which was then part of Germany. Your mother died during your birth. Were you cared for by your father?
No, my father was... I haven't seen my father more than 3-4 times. Because my father was banned by the Nazis he was a musicologist, a professor for musicology in the university in Breslau, but he was banned into a provincial place first and was not allowed to get back to Breslau and to see me. And
He was anti-Nazi?
Anti-Nazi, yes.
Uh-huh.
And then he was coming in disguise, so to say, to yet see me. And one found out, and then he was sent to a punishment bataillon in the war and was killed very immediately. So I have no real recollection of memory of my parents.
Who took care of you during the war?
My grandmother, mother of my mother.
So World War II ended when you were five. What did you and your grandmother do?
We were refugees for a year. And then my grandmother died in a refugee camp. And typhus broke out. And I was the only of 60 people in this camp who survived. And in the last minute, a cousin of my mother, who lived nearby, who had gotten a postcard of my grandmother but had gotten it 6 weeks after she died, tried to rescue me from this camp. The camp was under quarantine, and she gave some money to somebody and said that I was pulled out of this disaster in the last minute, actually.
So she was a musician,
yeah, you
know, a singer and a pianist?
A pianist, yeah.
Is that when you first heard the piano?
That's true, yeah. And during a rather long reconvalescence time, I heard her play and teach. She was not playing publicly in this time, but she was teaching a lot. And I was so fascinated by what I heard that the moment I could speak again, I was also kind of speechless for a year from these impressions.
You couldn't talk at all?
I didn't. I could, but I didn't. I was so so full of impressions. And music was then the vehicle and the outlet for the impressions which were so painful in me that I could communicate again and express myself again.
So you didn't speak for a year, over a year. Do you remember your internal process at that time?
Well, it was a process of processing these impressions. And the music was the thing which really helped me to get over it.
Listening.
Listening first and then doing it.
Do you remember when you first started to speak again?
Well, I said I want to play.
That was the first thing you said?
Yes.
Was it immediately clear when you started playing piano that you were very talented?
Talented or not talented, I was obsessed. And I think everybody is somehow talented, and in one field or the other. And that music was my field, that was evident very, very immediately.
Now, when did you know you wanted to be a conductor? Did that also become apparent very young?
When I was 11 years old, my stepmother took me to a concert with Furtwängler and the Berlin Philharmonic. And not that I saw the first time a conductor, but I saw the first time a conductor of that stature. And I was so fascinated to see how one person can inspire 100 people around him to make also obsessively music. And then my mother discovered that I really was totally overwhelmed by that and by the profession of this man who was the inspirator, so to say, of these other musicians. And asked me if I would eventually go into this direction. And I nodded with my head and said, yes, And she was very clever, and she gave me violin. At a week later, I had violin lessons because she said, you must learn an orchestra instrument if you want to have something to do with orchestra. And from this time on, I played for 12 years violin, and I'm very, very grateful for that because I know very much about string playing now and helped me a lot. And from her singing lessons, which I listened to very carefully, I got very much about breathing and about actually wind playing and in general about music making, which has to be always has to do always with breathing, with diction, and with a way to give life to a musical phrase.
I know this past Sunday you conducted at the memorial service for relatives of victims of the terrorist attacks at Ground Zero in New York City. I know your own life has been marked by war. Could you tell us what your impressions were?
Well, it was highly emotional, and arriving there at the site, it was like arriving in a bombed city of in 1945 in Europe. I went to the site physically, had an impression of the enormous hole which is there, and the air polluted and smelling, and the smoke still of burning ashes. I hardly could breathe, but the music making, I think, helped, and hopefully helped the people who were there, the families and friends of the victims.
Christoph Eschenbach, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Christoph Eschenbach was recently named the new music director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. He begins his tenure in 2003. Tonight, he conducts the New York Philharmonic at Lincoln Center. Here's Eschenbach playing the Rondo from Schubert's Piano Sonata in A. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Thunder and Lightning, Cracking Open the Writer's Craft by Natalie Goldberg, author of Wild Mind. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, following the terrorist money trail, we talk with William Wexler. He served in the Clinton administration as the director for transnational threats in the U.S. National Security Council. Join us for the next Fresh Air.